I'd like to call the Minnesota Senate Health and Human Services Finance and Policy Committee to order. It is Tuesday, March 4th, 2025, and we do have a quorum present. Our first bill on the agenda is Senate File 1861, Senator Housechild. Good morning and welcome to the committee, and please go ahead with your bill.
Greetings, Chair Wicklund and members of the committee. Today I have for you Senate File 1861, which relates to hospital swing bed licensing condition modifications. This is a bill to support North Shore Health, a small rural remote healthcare organization comprising a 16-bed critical access hospital, a 37-bed skilled nursing facility, a home health agency, and an ambulance service, all located in the very northeast corner of Minnesota in Cook County. The next closest nursing home is 60 miles away in Silver Bay, and the next closest hospital is over 80 miles away in Two Harbors. Like many rural healthcare facilities, they struggle financially and are looking for ways to reduce their losses. This bill provides an opportunity to increase the Medicare reimbursement for patients in the facility and will not increase the cost to the state of Minnesota. And with that, to sort of talk a little bit more about the details of the bill, I do have a testifier from North Shore Health, the CEO, Kimber Ralstead.
Thank you, and welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Wicklund and committee members. I'm Kimber Ralstead, the CEO, administrator of North Shore Health in Grand Marais, and I'm here to express my support for Senate File 1861. Several of you might remember me from legislation North Shore Health worked on in 2022, and I'm here today to finish that process. I'd like to give a little context for this legislation. For at least the last 20 years, the nursing home that is a part of North Shore Health has lost an average of $1.5 million a year, with this year's loss being over $2 million. The ability of North Shore Health to maintain these losses is not sustainable, even with an almost $1.9 million tax levy as a hospital district. As you all know, nursing home reimbursement does not allow any Minnesota nursing home to simply increase our charges to cover our expenses. As a hospital-attached nursing home, we are also subject to the Medicare hospital cost report rules and have to allocate expenses based upon those requirements. This usually results in moving expenses from a hospital cost center that are reimbursed 101% of allowed costs to the nursing home, where our costs exceed the limits established by the Minnesota Department of Human Services and the legislature. For example, in 2025, our nursing home other operating costs exceed the operating per diem limit by $74 per resident day. So these reimbursement rules have us moving expenses from one area where we could get some payment to an area where we are over the limits where we don't get paid at all. That's why I'm here today. North Shore Health is asking for a legislative change that will provide our organization with an opportunity to obtain at least $800,000, perhaps more, in funding. We're asking that we not be subject to the swing bed average length of stay limitation and for the ability to have Medicaid provide reimbursement for swing bed care in the hospital for nursing home type residents. So our intent is to reclassify one half of our nursing home and call it hospital. The only thing that would change for some of our residents is the name of the location of their room. It will be hospital versus nursing home and how their stay is reimbursed. So those covered by Medicaid would be reimbursed at the $299 state swing bed rate per day, rather than the nursing home case mix rate, where our lowest rate right now is $366 a day. So there will be no cost to the state of Minnesota. And I want to reiterate, there will be no cost to the state of Minnesota. What happens is by changing the areas of costs between the hospital and the nursing home differently on paper, it changes how we allocate our cost, thus increasing reimbursement from Medicare. Okay? This is a very specific legislative change that would only affect North Shore Health. And there are very few facilities that this would work for anyway. We have interacted with Minnesota Department of Health and Department of Human Services for years about this concept. Okay? Due to the financial losses, it has been periodically suggested that the nursing home be closed. And it has done many smaller facilities that had hospital-attached nursing home have done that throughout the years. but it also hurts my heart to think about closure as an option, because North Shore Health is the only skilled nursing home in the county, and we have no assisted living available. The members of our community who need this level of care would have to leave their community, and their family members and friends would have to travel possibly 2 hours or more to see them. I'd like to make a comment about one of my residents that actually passed away about 3 weeks ago. She was 100 years old. She missed being 101 by 7 days. She was a resident of Grand Portage. She had no children. Her friends were her family. She had numerous people come and see her weekly. And had she have been another 2 hours away, she would not have had that support. She was a beloved community member, and she had the ability to have her friends there because she was in community. Our North Shore Health goal is to remain viable so that we can continue to provide services to our community, such as the nursing home, home care, the hospital with the emergency department, and the ambulance services. We're asking you to help us do this, and I'm asking for your support of Senate File 1861. Thank you, Chair Wicklund, and committee members for your consideration.
Thank you. Members, do you have any questions or comments? Senator Abler.
Was that the end of the testimony?
Yes.
All right. Well, yeah. I mean, holy cow, here we are just trying to piecemeal a whole greater Minnesota, you know, really lean infrastructure together. You know, we're a highly regulated state, Senator Housechild, and to your testifier, and here we have to just parse ways to help you hang on. So, absolutely. Thank you.
Any other members, questions or comments? Seeing none, Senator Housechild, any final thoughts? I mean, it certainly is a... It's a unique situation and certainly provides unique services and the ability for people to stay in their community, which is certainly really, really important. Senator Housechild?
Thanks, Chair Wicklund, for the comments, and other committee members. Thank you, Senator Abler, for your comments as well. For those of you that haven't been to Cook County, I want to encourage you to go, because it's truly a special place. It's on the very tip of the Arrowhead. It's a very, frankly, isolated community with one highway going straight up the North Shore to get there. It's also a place that binds together to take on the challenges that they face as a rural community, unlike anywhere else that I've seen. And the partnership that they have with the tribal nation nearby in Grand Portage is also something that I have never seen in our state, and let alone some of the incredible partnerships that they have that nationwide are leading the way in tribal and community partnerships. So I just want to say that the work that North Shore Health is doing, that Kimber is doing to try to make this work, to Senator Abler's point, I think is really important. And we as a state have to help these rural communities be able to provide the core services that many of us take for granted in more populated areas. If not for this change and changes like this across many of the rural hospitals that I represent in some of the most rural communities in the state, I fear that these rural critical access hospitals will someday close. And that is just a reality. We've already seen it happen in places across our state and nation. And so I really hope that you take seriously this legislation, which would just make a change that doesn't cost the state any money, but can make a heck of a difference for a rural hospital trying to care for patients like the one she described. So thank you so much, Madam Chair and committee members, for your consideration.
Thank you. Thank you. And it is a beautiful area of the state. I enjoy going up there multiple times a year, and I really appreciate your coming down, driving down to testify today, and I hope you are able to get home without having too much travel difficulties. Senator Housechild, I think we should, I'd like to just confirm with a fiscal note that, you know, we have the costs are zero for the state, and so we will lay the bill over today. Senate File 1861 is laid over. Thank you very much. Next, we will move to Senate File 164, Senator Weber. Yeah. Good morning. Welcome to the HHS committee and Senate File 164. I think you have presented it in higher education, and it needs to come to us, and then we're going to be passing it out back to higher education. So go ahead, Senator Weber, and present your bill.
Madam Chair, members, thank you so much. It's my honor this morning again to present Senate File 164. I authored Senate File 164 due to a constituent who brought me a situation that had occurred in his family. And as most of you know, I don't often appear before the HHS committee, and members of my caucus are grinning already. But the reality of it is that when I heard the story of this family, I knew that this was a bill that I needed to carry. And as a result, the purpose of the bill is relatively straightforward and simple. What it does is it requires our state college and university system, as well as University of Minnesota, to maintain a supply of opiate antagonists and also then provide at least 2 doses of nasal opiate antagonist available on site at each campus residential facility. And this is a situation, I think, that with what we see happening in terms of overdoses of in our young people, particularly those at the college age, I believe is a necessary step that we as the state should take. And I have with me via Zoom this morning, Madam Chair, 2 testifiers, and the first testifier, Will Rops, is the young gentleman that came to me with his family story, and he wishes to share it with you.
Thank you. Will Rops, if you can please state your name for the record and begin your testimony. And we aren't hearing your testimony, so let's get that addressed. It looks like you unmuted, so maybe it's something in our...
Can you hear me?
Yes, now we can hear you.
Okay.
Please state your name and go ahead.
Yep, my name is Will Rops, and first of all, I just want to say thank you to the Human Services and Finance Committee for having me today. I'm here to testify on behalf of SF-164. So on November 17th of 2022, my mom, Tish, came back from her second job as a health home aide to find her oldest son, Justin, lifeless, cold to the touch, and dead. Justin died of a fentanyl overdose at just 25 years old. He left behind a legacy of being a star athlete, a loving boyfriend, and a human being full of compassion, working as a paraprofessional for struggling children in alternative schools. Every single day, families in Minnesota, the Midwest, and the entire country are being ripped apart by the opioid and fentanyl epidemic in this country. I'm here today because I want to save lives, and I want to protect other families from experiencing the tragedy that mine has, by testifying in support of SF-164. When Justin died, I was a junior at Minnesota State University Moorhead, and I think everybody in that room is aware that college is a time of transition. You know, it's a time when people want to try new things, they want to experiment. In that transitioning time, it just simply means college students are more likely to use opioids. They're more vulnerable. My brother, even at the time, was taking classes online to become a special education teacher. After Justin's death, it became clear to me that while our universities rightfully focused on using opioids to begin with, they lack framework to support students still choosing to use opioids on campus. This framework can begin with you, the Minnesota legislature, by stocking Axalon on campus and residence halls where students are most likely to be overdosing. By choosing not to keep Naxalon in residence halls, we're basically subjecting students to unjustifiable death sentences. relying on students being lucky enough not to receive opioids laced with fentanyl or to be extremely intentional about the amount they are taking. At my former university, not only is naloxone not stocked in residence halls, but it's also not even being currently carried by campus security. So if a student were to overdose at Moorhead, they would be reliant first on emergency services being called, then on those emergency services being able to get into the residence halls, then they need to find the overdosing person in the residence hall, and then administer the naloxone, reversing the overdose. And that is far too many steps. In October of last year, Minnesota's Department of Health released data showing that overdose deaths decreased between 2022 and 2023 by 8%. That is in large part thanks to Narcan and naloxone being more available. Because of a single fentanyl-laced pill, my family's life was changed forever. Justin's death, I can confidently say, was the worst moment of my life. For me, it meant no more family trips, no more family dinner memories, and no more Sunday afternoon football trash-talking sessions with my brother. For his girlfriend of 4 years, it meant no wedding, no babies, and no growing old with Justin. And for my mom, it meant no more big, warm Justin bear hugs. I began working on this bill because I wanted to turn my grief into action. And now, after nearly 2 years of working on it, most of my work is done, and I'm passing the rest of it on to members of this committee and the Minnesota legislature. By passing SF-164, you have the opportunity to be part of the solution to ending overdose deaths in Minnesota. We are in a position to lead the country in overdose response. I'm asking this committee today to help make Minnesota a guiding star for what it means to care about our communities. Help us get a step closer to ending overdose deaths once and for all, and help me ensure that Minnesota families don't experience the horrible tragedy that mine has gone through. I thank this committee for their time and consideration. That's all I have.
Thank you very much for your testimony, and I'm very sorry for your loss. And thank you very much for putting your efforts into a tangible response to try and help others. Next, we have Elena Dahlquist, who is on Zoom as well. If you could please unmute and please state your name for the record and begin.
Yep. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Elena Dahlquist, and I'm the State Government Affairs Manager at the National Safety Council, the country's leading workplace safety advocate. And I'm here today to respectfully ask you to support SF-164, a bill that would require public post-secondary institutions in Minnesota to maintain a supply of opioid antagonists on campus. In addition to being places for students to learn, schools are also many people's workplace. No industry or occupation is immune to the opioid crisis, and workplace overdose deaths have increased over 600% since 2011. Nationally, overdose deaths now account for nearly 1 in 10 worker deaths on the job. Opioid overdose reversal medications, such as naloxone, are safe, effective, and can save a life. These medications can easily be administered and temporarily reverse overdoses from licit and illicit opioids. They are not habit-forming, and they are not harmful to people when administered. Now that these medications are available over the counter, they should be considered an essential component of emergency response preparedness. Both the National Safety Council and the Minnesota Safety Council support ready access to opioid antagonists in all organizations, including educational settings. Anyone at a workplace, including workers, clients, customers, visitors, and students, is at risk of overdosing if they are using opioids. Many public and private organizations, both across the state and across the country, have already incorporated overdose response into their emergency plans, reflecting a growing recognition of the workplace as a critical setting for harm reduction efforts and demonstrating a commitment to protecting public health and safety. We encourage the state to continue its naloxone saturation efforts and pass this legislation to expand access to these life-saving medications to post-secondary institutions. Thank you for your attention to this issue.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions or comments about the bill? Senator Ambler.
I guess it's my job today, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. When the time comes, I'll move the bill, but it's a great idea. I don't know why we don't do this now. I was actually reading your fiscal note, and it's one of the most nickel-dime fiscal notes I've seen. You have to have a 0.1 FTE to hang up the boxes, the little containers. And so, I mean, this should go forward. I would hate to see this fall apart because of literally nickels and dimes on the fiscal note. And the biggest cost is at the U. They should just do this for free. And there's not much money this year, Senator Weber, and we shouldn't let people die because there's not. You're a particularly skilled senator. I know Mary Turner is on the Regents at the U as a nurse, and this would be important to her. If they couldn't find extremely small costs to put in those things, and this should be done for free. My encouragement to you, and happy to support you in that, and Meg, the U Regents, and tell Minnesota State, like, they have maintenance people. Like, oh, well, today you're going to hang up some little boxes, like, and not charge you for that on the fiscal note. So this is a time to be, you know, frugal and thoughtful and save some lives, and I'm all in. And, if there's a room, I'd like to sign on. So thank you.
Senator Kupek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Weber, too, for bringing this bill. I'll echo many of the sentiments here by Senator Abler, and sometimes I think there is some misconceptions around these anti-opioid treatments that somehow they could be taken and be addicted to, and that is just not the case. And they are very easy to administer. You know, coffee shops have been taking these with very simple training. You can save lives, and everybody, you know, all of these people who are losing their lives, there's somebody's as son, daughter, you know, brother, sister, and this could be, you know, the one time that, you know, can turn things around. So thanks very much, and I will agree with Senator Abler. I'll sign on too.
Thank you. Any other member questions? Senator Oetke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And we can't just let Senator Weber off the hook without saying anything more. But so I have to ask, like it's been said, I mean, it's a good bill, but how is it tracking in the other body?
Senator Weber.
Madam Chair, Senator Oetke, it has been introduced in the other body, and the hearing has been requested, and I have not been given a particular date as to when that hearing is going to be held due to their somewhat late start over there. I know that there is an author. It has been introduced, and we're waiting for that hearing.
Senator Oetke.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Weber.
Senator, I don't see any other questions or comments. Senator Weber, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for the kind comments, members. You know, over the last few years, we have seen a prolific rise in the amount of fentanyl that has entered this country. And as a legislature, there's not much we can do that can affect the entire country. However, there is something we can do that affects our colleges and universities and provide an avenue where we can save lives. And for that reason, Madam Chair and members, I thank you for this hearing, and I encourage your support of this bill.
Thank you. It is an important bill, and I appreciate your bringing it forward. Members, Senator Abler moves that Senate File 164 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Higher Education. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye. Aye. Any opposed? The motion does prevail. Senate File 164 is passed and referred to the Committee on Higher Education.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Senate File 1175, Senator Bolden. And this is a bill that has been heard in Human Services, and we will be discussing it, and then it needs to go back to the Human Services Committee. Senator Boland.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm grateful to be before you with Senate File 1175. This is a bill that would extend Minnesota's existing hospital preemptive eligibility program to allow that presumptive eligibility determination for medical assistance for infants with a positive newborn screen. This would connect that presumptive eligibility for Medicaid with that positive newborn screen to ensure that infants with urgent medical needs receive the immediate care that they need. It will reduce delays in treatment that could lead to severe health complications or death. It also facilitates hospital decompression by allowing faster discharge of patients who need long-term services and supports, ensuring that they can transition to appropriate care settings without unnecessary delays. I want to say just a little bit about the newborn screening process we have in Minnesota. We really are a leader in that screening. We test for over 60 conditions that, if left untreated, can cause illness, profound disability, developmental delays, or even death. We know that early intervention saves lives and reduces costs. A study by the Everlife Foundation found that early diagnosis of rare diseases can save up to $500,000 per patient in medical expenses and productivity losses. And as mentioned again, in some cases, it is literally life-saving. So what is presumptive eligibility? It is a process that we already have. It allows immediate temporary Medicaid or CHIP coverage for children and pregnant women while their full application is being processed. These are people who are eligible for Medicaid. It just speeds up the otherwise lengthy process for that. Our current existing hospital presumptive eligibility program permits participating hospitals to enroll patients in Medicaid with basic information like income and household size, ensuring access to care. So this bill will have profound impacts by providing that immediate access to care. So infants who test positive for a congenital or heritable disorder, they often require urgent medical intervention. This presumptive eligibility will ensure that they receive that timely delivery of care that will be covered. We know that they have this condition that will mean that they qualify for Medicaid. It just speeds up that process. And streamlines the access to their care. It will improve health outcomes. We know that early intervention is critical for infants diagnosed with severe conditions. By facilitating this prompt access to medical assistance, we can improve survival rates and long-term health outcomes. And I will add, lessen the stress on the parents of these infants who are dealing with a lot in those moments. You know, having just given birth, realizing that they're, you know, what they expected to be a newborn baby has these health challenges that they weren't expecting. That is a whole thing in itself. On top of having to navigate the Medicaid health insurance system is a whole other thing that they, you know, do not need in that moment. And then just the enhancing the healthcare efficiency, streamlining that eligibility process reduces administrative burdens on hospitals and healthcare providers and really allows them to focus on that patient care rather than other bureaucratic hurdles. And with that, Madam Chair, would move to testimony.
Thank you. Let's see. Do you want to go first, Ms. Barnes? There is a testifier on Zoom as well.
Would it be okay if Dr. Orchard goes first? He has clinic coming up. That's why he's virtual.
So. It's just fine. I just wasn't sure if you were preparing to go first. So,
thank you.
Dr. Paul Orchard, if you could please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Yeah.
Looks like we have a technical difficulty. See if we can get Dr. Orchard back. He is still on, but maybe we should Erica Barnes,
sure.
If you could please go ahead with your testimony, we'll see if we can get Dr. Orchard back. Thank
sure.
you.
Sure. Chair Wicklund and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of Senate File 1175, which allows hospitals to establish presumptive eligibility for Medicaid on the basis of a positive newborn screen. My name is Erica Barnes, and I'm the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council Executive Director. The Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council is an executive branch state agency established in 2022 whose mission is to provide advice on improving care for the 1 in 10 Minnesotans living with a rare disease. We organize our work around four priority pillars, one of which is reducing the time to a rare disease diagnosis. Within our function as an advisory to other government agencies, we believe that working with MDH and DHS to strengthen our newborn screening program through both disease identification and efficient follow-up care is critical to making progress on this pillar. Since its establishment in 1966, newborn infant screening has grown into one of the most successful public health initiatives in the U.S., saving countless lives and averting significant health care costs. Each year, greater than 98% of the U.S.'s newborns are screened, and over 12,500 are diagnosed with a serious health condition. In Minnesota in 2023, 440 newborns were identified with a heritable or congenital disorder that required urgent intervention, and 178 were identified with permanent hearing loss. And these numbers will continue to grow as medical advancement for rare diseases continues at an unprecedented pace, allowing us to add more rare diseases to our newborn screening panel. And these new diseases are going to be complex medical diseases. Researchers right here in our state are discovering cures and treatments for rare diseases that were once considered outside of the scope of medicine. And for some of these diseases, the cruel irony is that once symptoms begin to appear, which is the typical pathway for being able to diagnose a disease, the child has lost the window of opportunity for any sort of treatment. Newborn screening is quite literally their only hope of survival. But early identification is only the beginning. Proactive follow-up and timely delivery of intervention is vital to avoid a lifetime of disability or even death. And any delay, such as a lack of clarity around insurance coverage as families navigate both the birth of a child and the unexpected diagnosis, just like Senator Bolden mentioned, can have catastrophic consequences. Due to the rigor of adding a disease to the newborn screening panel and the criteria a disease must meet, the Minnesota Rare Disease Advisory Council believes that a positive newborn screen is a strong proxy for identifying children who will qualify for Medicaid through the disability determination process. But this determination process takes time. Allowing hospitals to presume eligibility for Medicaid immediately while waiting for the final SMRT determination will expedite delivery of care to these children and ensure that no child misses the window of a life-saving treatment. This piece of legislation streamlines an already complex and traumatizing process. Families, such as mine was, who have a child with a life-threatening disease, deserve the right to focus all of their energy and attention on saving that child's life. Let's support these families by taking away an administrative hurdle so that they don't have to take the focus away from their child. Please support Senate File 1175.
Thank you very much for your testimony. We don't have Dr. Orchard back on the line or back on the Zoom, so we'll just go ahead with discussion of the bill. Members, any questions or comments about the bill? Senator Abler. Or did you?
Giving it two thumbs up, Madam Chair.
Oh, okay. So
we heard
all
it
right,
in
no
the
comments.
Committee, and this is just something we should do. So, thank you.
Seeing no further questions, Senator Bolden, any final thoughts?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I want to thank the Rare Disease Advisory Council for their partnership on this and Senator Kupek for being a co-author. And note this bill obviously does have bipartisan support. It really is a common sense way to streamline processes for both hospitals as well as, most importantly, families who are dealing with very difficult circumstances. Thank you.
And I think Dr. Orator did rejoin the Zoom. If it's possible for him to unmute and see if he can provide his testimony, we can take that at this time.
I'm sorry if that didn't work previously, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Yeah, please go ahead.
Okay. Thank you very much. Good morning. My name is Paul Orchard. I'm a professor in the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Minnesota. I'm also a member of the Rare Disease Advisory Council for the state of Minnesota. My practice is focused on the use of cell and gene therapy approaches for children with rare inherited life-threatening conditions. I very much appreciate the opportunity and privilege to speak with you this morning on behalf of Bill SF-1175, in particular as to the relevance in babies identified by newborn screening. Minnesota has been a leader in the use of newborn screening to identify infants with serious medical conditions as early as possible. Some of these disorders require immediate care to achieve the best outcomes possible for the affected infants. This bill expands Minnesota's existing hospital presumptive eligibility program to allow immediate Medicare coverage while a full application is being processed. This will benefit babies identified by newborn screening or other issues such as congenital heart disease. In my view, this will be advantageous in a number of ways. First, it will help ensure access to immediate care. In some of these disorders, as I mentioned, early intervention can make all the difference. I saw an infant yesterday, now almost a year old, who was diagnosed with globoid cell leukodystrophy by newborn screening. This is a rapidly progressive neurologic disorder that, if untreated, is lethal in infancy. Our genetics group and I first learned of his diagnosis and began working with the family on Easter Sunday last year, a few days after he was born. The benchmark is to proceed with a bone marrow transplant by 30 days of life. And in his situation, he was 25 days old at the time of his transplant. As he did well, he was eligible for a gene therapy approach to increase the delivery of the missing enzyme called galactocerebrosidase. And when I saw him yesterday, he was standing independently. Neurologically, we're very encouraged how he's doing. In contrast, many children with his disease are dead by 2 or 3 years of age. Secondly, while in this circumstance, we were able to negotiate the Medicaid situation relatively quickly, doing so took a great deal of time, both with the group helping us with Medicaid and in the group within the hospital trying to cement the coverage. And I believe Bill SF-1175 will assist in streamlining that process, taking that pressure off everyone involved. Third, while many families have private insurance, confirmation of coverage for a newborn can take time. And with a private insurance carrier, if Medicaid is currently available, this will help ensuring immediate and comprehensive care while the other coverage is being confirmed. Fourth, and importantly, as was mentioned before, this bill will help the families focus on the care of their sick babies, eliminating insurance-related concerns in an extremely stressful time will provide peace of mind for the families and allow them to concentrate on the medical and family issues associated with a serious new diagnosis in their newborns. In summary, I believe Bill SF-1175 will be important to provide the best means of optimizing the care of infants diagnosed by newborn screening. It seems to make a great deal of sense as performing screening to identify treatable disorders as early as possible, and then experiencing delays based on insurance seems counterproductive. In my view, Bill SF-1175 will prove very advantageous, and I believe other states will take the lead of Minnesota and embrace this process as well. I hope you support the bill, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. And I really appreciate your joining the Zoom again so that we could hear that information. Again, members, do you have any other questions now? Seeing none, this bill, as I mentioned, needs to go back to the Human Services Committee. So Senator Bolden moves that Senate File 1175 be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Human Services. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 1175 is passed and referred to the Committee on Human Services. Thank you. And next we go to Senate File 143, Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we are going to continue on the path of creating efficiencies related to Medicaid in a different way in this bill. This bill does help to create efficiencies in Medicaid prescription coverage. As we know, Medicaid is the payer of last resort, and many people with disabilities have dual coverage. They may have primary commercial coverage through an employer, a parent, or a spouse, or they may have additional Medicare coverage. This additional coverage saves the state money in Medicaid payments by taking the brunt of many costs. However, when people have dual coverage, there are sometimes complications that come with that, particularly when they are trying to fill prescriptions. They often face formulary and insurance challenges. This bill aims to create efficiency and ensure that Medicaid covers the co-pays while ensuring that the primary insurance formulary is used at maximum value. Additionally, these formulary issues create delays for patients as they try to work with their pharmacists and doctors to find solutions, sometimes leading to more significant consequences that end up costing our healthcare system more money. And I'll give you an example of that from my own community. There was a patient who had Medicaid coverage, also was under 26, so had coverage of a commercial plan through their parent. Doctor prescribed a medication for them, a psychiatric medication that was on the formulary of the commercial insurance, but it was not on the formulary for Medicaid. And so Medicaid could not cover the copay for that medication. Because of the policy at the pharmacy, the parent could not even just out of their own pocket pay the copay for that medication. They just could not get that medication, which created a delay. They then had to go back to the provider and try to figure out, okay, do we need to get a different medication? What medication is on both of the formularies? How do we navigate this? Through that delay and confusion and time, the patient ended up having a psychiatric break, went in through the emergency department, and was hospitalized. And it was Medicaid that paid for that hospitalization for that patient. So outside of being a traumatic experience for the patient and unnecessary, it was a big expense for Medicaid and for the state. And so there are that is not a one-off. There are many examples I could give of similar situations, and we will have a testifier to speak to that as well. So with this bill, it will create that efficiency to allow Medicaid to just pay for the copay for that medication, so patients can get the medications that they need, the medications that their providers are saying that they need, in a more cost-effective and efficient way.
Thank you, Senator Boland. I see that there is an A1 amendment. Did you want to adopt that as an author's
amendment? I would, Madam Chair. Thank you for that. The A1 is just technical in nature. It does not change the substance of the bill, and thank you to Council for providing that input.
Thank you. Members, Senator Boland moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and the A1 is adopted. So you have testifier Jillian Nelson.
Yes. Good morning, Chair Wicklund and committee members. My name is Jillian Nelson, and I'm the policy director for the Autism Society of Minnesota. Today, I'm also here as a Medicaid recipient. I'm on medical assistance for employed people with disabilities, and every month I pay for my private health care and then a premium for my MAPD. This has been great, and I've gotten the supports I need and the health care that keeps me alive most of the time. 13 years ago, I was diagnosed pre-diabetic. Through diet, exercise, and medicine, I've managed to keep my A1C at a regular level, and I have not crossed that line to diabetic. This was important to me because of all the health impacts of full-blown diabetes. However, in January this year, that changed. I went to pick up the medication I had been on all year, the same medication that got my A1C to a great place, reduced my inflammation from fibro, and helped my body do what it needed to do to be healthy. I had a prior authorization from my private insurance, but Medicaid wouldn't pay for it, leaving me with a copay that far exceeded my financial ability, especially when paying for two types of health care, which are over $600 a month. It took 3 weeks for medical assistance to get the prior authorization approved. And in those 3 weeks, I became a full-blown diabetic. I had 5 additional doctor's appointments to deal with this, a glucose meter, test strips, lancets, and an emergency room visit. Medicaid paid for all of those. This current practice is harmful not just to the patients, but also to our state budget. In my scenario, medical assistance paid approximately $8,000 more than had my medication just been covered, as it had been all the months before. We are talking very intensely this session about how to fix Medicaid overspending, and this is a prime example of how there are places we can reduce spending and increase health outcomes for the people served. I didn't have to be a diabetic. But now I am, and we don't get to change that. but we can change the future outcomes for the rest of the state. Thank you for your time this morning and for your support of Senate File 143.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions or comments on the bill? Senator Edke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Got a couple of questions. First off, it's referenced a couple times in here. They use the term cost effective. What is the definition of that? Is that something in statute already that we can refer to?
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Utke, for the question. I would defer to counsel to say if that is defined in statute.
Mr. Hidalgo, do you have any information you can provide?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Utke, as far as I'm aware, that is not defined anywhere in statute. That is left up to the Commissioner of Human Services discretion.
Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that was going to be my follow-up, was who is deciding what is cost-effective, and is it falling back strictly on the Commissioner?
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the question. So I think as we hear it, you know, it would fall to the Commissioner. And I think, you know, as we think about cost effective, given the example we just heard, you know, an additional $8,000 paid for visits, hospital stays, et cetera, certainly outweighs, is more than what the cost of the copay would have been. I'll give you another example from my own life. My son, who has is on medical assistance because of his disabilities, is under 26, so he is also on my commercial insurance through my employer. Because of one of his medical conditions, he gets injections every 3 months. Provider said that he needed an increased dose of those injections, that was not because of the interaction between the commercial insurance and Medicaid. We couldn't get that worked out. There was a mismatch there, wouldn't be covered because of that, and it caused delays. Because of that, we had to switch to a different medication that was on both of the formularies, and that medication has to be given under anesthesia. And so now, because of that change of medication, increased cost of medication, and, you know, instead of going to having a clinic visit, we're going to it's a procedure with anesthesia. So outside of just the increased risk for him, it's far more costly. And so as we talk about cost effective, there are definitely ways to just, you know, have Medicaid cover the copay, the additional cost to have the medications that, you know, physicians are saying that patients need, without having to work around it and have additional much higher expenses.
Senator Edke, I believe Council has found some information to provide to Mr. Hodal.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Senator Edke, Senator Bolden. Upon further review, there actually is a definition in Chapter 256B on what cost-effective means. The definition is that it means that the amount paid by the state for premiums, coinsurance, deductibles, other cost-sharing obligations under a health insurance plan, and other administrative costs is likely to be less than the amount paid for an equivalent set of services paid by medical assistance.
Thank you. Senator Edke.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. And that is good, I guess, because what I was looking at it, you know, prior to that was the fact of it appeared we didn't know really cost effective was kind of loose, and relying on the Commissioner to get back to make this decision, it didn't seem like a timely process, and I think the timely process is what you're after. And I was wondering where it needed to go to give you the result you were really looking for, but maybe this will help some. And I can see it getting lost in the shuffle yet when it still goes to the Commissioner for approval, but however they mainstream that would be better, so thank you.
Any other member questions? Comments? I don't see any others. It does seem like there should be a better way to try and avoid, and it sounds like there should be a process to evaluate, and hopefully, you know, a bill like this would help with that and could help us save some money too, as well as the impact on patients. Senator Bolden, any final comments?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you to the committee for considering. I mean, I do think this is a win-win. It is both something that would impact patients in a positive way, ensuring that they can get the medications that their providers are saying that they need, and it will be saving the state dollars in terms of being the most efficient and effective way to spend the dollars, you know, to ensure people get the care that they need.
Thank you. And this bill, Senate File 143, will be laid over to get fiscal note information. So Senate File 143, as amended, is laid over.
Thank you.
Next, we go to Senator Kupek, 1173. Senator Kupek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, I have Senate File 1173. We are, as state of Minnesota, we enter into compacts and contracts with our surrounding states to provide mental health care services. Obviously, we live in, like, my community in Moorhead, being right attached to Fargo, that oftentimes the closest area to go to services is just a few blocks away, but it's across the state border, which sometimes complicates things. What it's come to my attention here in providing some of these mental health services is that people on probation or parole are not allowed to access that treatment just across the border when it might actually be the closest place to their house. In some cases, Prairie St. John's, which is literally on the river, I could throw a rock from Minnesota and knock out a window probably in their building. That is a benefit to those people if they can stay within their community to receive that treatment. So this bill does simple things. It just takes out the part about being on probation or parole, and then it also adds that if we enter into a contract with another state that allows this, that there has to be a notification sent to the commissioner. There is similar legislation moving actually through the North Dakota legislature to allow those people who are on probation or parole to actually seek that treatment on the North Dakota side of the river. And with that, I have a couple of testifiers.
Thank you. And let's first go, we do have North Dakota Senator Tim Mathern, who is on Zoom. Senator Mathern, welcome to the Minnesota HHS Committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair Wicklund and committee members. My name is Tim Mathern. I'm a state senator from Fargo, North Dakota, and ask Senator Kupek to introduce this legislation. But I've got some history in that Senator Kevin Goodnow and I introduced similar legislation 30 years ago, he from Moorhead, I from Fargo, and this bill is essentially an upgrade to that legislation. This essentially amends both Minnesota law and then us in North Dakota law to extend services across the border for not only all citizens who are general citizens, but also citizens who are on probation and parole. We need it for three reasons. One is, as you know, our law enforcement community has been much more active in promoting treatment. We understand that just putting people in jail without treatment essentially creates a situation where there's a further violation and a return to jail and incarceration. So if they get treatment, the recidivism goes down dramatically. So we need it for that reason. Secondly, we just don't have enough facilities between our state. So if we can share facilities between our two states, we all benefit. In a pragmatic matter, Moorhead has a substance use Medicaid or medical detox facility, and Fargo has a psychiatric hospital. so we can share those services back and forth. And thirdly, this bill is needed because it expands on the interstate compact agreements that our Departments of Human Services have in place. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, we need this to serve each other. We need this to serve our citizens. My only question as I read the bill is there an emergency clause so that if you pass it and the governor signs it, it would go into effect immediately? Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. I'd be glad to address any questions that you have.
Thank you. Next, we'll go to Ty Hegland. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Well, thank you, Chair Wicklund and members of the committee. My name is Ty Hegland. I serve as CEO of Prairie St. John's. We are a 132-bed acute psychiatric hospital located in Fargo, North Dakota. Or as Senator Kupek noted, we are literally a stone's throw away from Minnesota. Our back of our building backs to the Red River. Annually, we receive nearly 12,000 referrals for service. And it's pretty hard to believe that 132-bed facility can have that many. And 50% of these referrals come from Minnesota. I asked for a due pass on SF 1173. And though this bill and interstate compacts can sound incredibly technical, at times when you read through them, they can be incredibly wonky for the layperson. This bill is really about removing five words and providing more access to care for individuals who are afflicted by behavioral health diseases. If we think about the world of behavioral health and how it's evolved over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years, we know that not only is medical complexity going up, but behavioral health complexity is going through the roof. And the individuals that we are seeing, we are very fortunate that we can be able to benchmark their complexity. Their complexity has gone up nearly 20% over the last few years. And so we're receiving more and more individuals who are sicker. Quite often, with these referrals that we were receiving from Minnesota, we have ERs on the other side of these referrals. I think it's 80% of our referrals come from an ER, critical access hospital, med-surg facility. And due to this limitation, we end up with frustrated partners on the other side who are simply just trying to help out their community member. I think about, as I drove down from Park Rapids yesterday in our cabin in the woods, and you pass through all these small communities, and I think about all the critical access hospitals that we partner with on a daily basis. I think about all those patients that we're not able to save due to or serve due to this bill. We code these patients, and we call them deflections. It's a misnomer of a word. But we code these patients annually, and last year was nearly 1,500 patients that we had to deflect who were seeking these types of services. So in essence, this bill is really about five things. One, it's about providing closer access to care. When you look up and down western Minnesota, even in central Minnesota, there are deserts when it comes to behavioral health care. And then when you go up in complexity, particularly acute psychiatric care, there's few and far between. Quite often, a good chunk of our patients come from the Twin Cities metro area as well. They're being transported from ERs and ambulances, and we're serving a vast area. Second, this is about risk reduction for patients. People who are afflicted by probation, parole, clearly they've earned their sentence. But the last thing that we want to do as a provider or as citizens is increase the severity of their mental illness by not being able to provide them timely access. When we think about our community particularly, I look over at Moorhead every day and I wonder how many patients we don't serve because of this bill. Third is about risk reduction for law enforcement. Senator Mathern did an incredible job of laying that out. One of our number one proponents of this bill is law enforcement, who are asking for the ability to reduce risk with some of these individuals that they are getting repeated calls to. Rather than show up to their house as law enforcement and bring them to jail multiple times, they'd rather be able to get these individuals to treatment. And I think the last two pieces are pretty self-explanatory. One, for a lot of the ERs in this area, the frustration that they receive, we want to be able to be responsive to them. And finally, we want to be able to clear up their beds. These individuals who don't receive care, end up sitting in ERs and critical access hospitals and med-surg facilities for an extended period of time. I think last week alone we had one referral that was referred to us four different times from the same facility, hoping that we could come up with some magic solution to be able to serve them. And simply it was this law that was the barrier to it, or this interstate agreement that was the barrier to it. And so in closing, I would sincerely ask for a due pass on this bill and stand for any questions you may have.
Thank you very much for your testimony. I have one other testifier, Madison Hansen. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the record and begin your testimony.
For the record, my name is Madison Hansen, and thank you for allowing me to be here. Good morning, Madam Chairwoman Wilkund, members of the committee. My name is Madison Hansen, and I am here today as a concerned citizen and mental health advocate from North Dakota to voice my strong support for SF 1173. While I do not currently reside in Minnesota, I grew up here. I have the majority of my family in this state, and I currently attend graduate school here for social work. I stand before you, well, sit, I guess, a little different than North Dakota, because the barriers this bill seeks to remove do not stop at state lines. Mental illness does not recognize borders, and neither should access to treatment. This legislation addresses a critical gap by allowing individuals on probation or parole to receive essential mental health services across state lines. As a member of the National Alliance on Mental Illness, NAMI North Dakota, I am well aware of how restrictions on mental health care access create unnecessary hardships, and not just for individuals seeking recovery, but for the entire justice system, communities, and families. Under the current system, individuals on probation or parole are often denied access to essential mental health care simply because of where they live, forcing them into an impossible situation that increases their risk of reoffending, relapse, or crisis. And we know that access to consistent, high-quality mental health care reduces recidivism, improves long-term stability, and ultimately saves taxpayer dollars by decreasing reliance on emergency services, jails, and hospitals. SF 1173 removes a barrier, ensuring that people receive the care they need when and where they most need it. Furthermore, as someone actively working on similar legislation in North Dakota, I urge you to see this bill as an opportunity to set a precedent. If Minnesota takes this step forward, it sends a powerful message, not just to neighboring states like mine, but across the country, that mental health treatment should never be obstructed by geography. I respectfully ask this committee to vote yes on SF 1173. This is more than a policy adjustment. It is a lifeline for those seeking to rebuild their lives. Thank you for your time and your leadership on this critical issue, and I stand for any questions.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Members, do you have any questions? Senator Adkey?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I've got a question just out of curiosity I guess this would be for Ty. The name Prairie St. John's, are you located on the old location of St. John's Hospital? Is that where this started from?
Chair Wicklund, Senator Utke. Yes, that is correct. We essentially adopted the old critical access med-surg facility that was located there. And then within the last 2 years, we demoed, recycled 95% of that building, and built a new hospital on the Fargo side of the river.
Senator Utke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious as I saw this, because if you go back many, many, many decades ago, St. John's is where I was born. So that's why I was trying to make this connection. So for whatever that's worth, thank you.
Other members, do you have questions or comments? Senator Port.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Kupek, for bringing this. It makes a ton of sense to make sure that our states are working together in a way that serves people. But I think more critically, to me, I really appreciate the removal of the exception for folks on probation and parole. So many times, a mental health crisis is the first interaction folks have with the justice system. And if that is not treated, it can be a continued lifetime interaction, and it's so important that we actually treat the root cause and address mental health. So really appreciate you bringing this bill.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? No. Senator Kupik, any final thoughts?
No, I'm just happy to do this. It is, you know, one of those things, living on the border where our communities are so intertwined that the Red River really does not mean anything. I also will add, I've just learned that the North Dakota legislature makes all their testifiers stand. Maybe that moves things along faster if we don't get a nice cushy chair, but I don't know if we want to adopt that either, but thanks.
Thank you. We were trying to discern whether there would be any cost to this, and so far, we don't think so, Senator Kupek. So, you know, I guess we could pass it out of the committee and just, you know, pass it to the floor, or we can lay it over and do more investigation. Senator Mathern, did you have a comment or a question?
Yes, thank you. The memorandum of agreement, then, that would be taken under consideration by both the commissioner in Minnesota and the commissioner in North Dakota would essentially clarify that the expenses would stay with the state where the patient is from. So there would be no additional cost to either state. Thank you.
So it sounds like thank you for that, Senator Mathern. It sounds like there wouldn't be a cost for implementing the bill itself, and costs to patients would be handled as they are today. So I think that we could pass it out of committee if that's, and just send it to the floor. Members, any other questions or comments? Senator Kupek, your motion would be Senate File 1173 no amendment. Senate File 1173 be recommended to pass and be placed on general orders. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion does prevail. Senate File 1173 is passed. Thank you. And now we have Senator Mann, Senate File 1858. Senator Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. 1858 is the Market Bucks Program bill. I do have an A1 author's amendment that is a technical amendment, Madam Chair.
Senator Mann, I see an A2 amendment.
Oh, A2, sorry.
And Senator Mann moves the A2 amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The A2 amendment is adopted. Senator Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this bill will move the Market Bucks program from the Humanity Center to MDH and will expand this nutrition incentive model from the farmers market, which has been in place for over a decade, to also include grocery stores through a new pilot program. This will allow access to fresh fruits and vegetables all year round. Market Bucks incentivizes low-income Minnesotans to eat fresh fruits and vegetables by stretching their dollars when they do so. Many other states are doing this, have been doing this, including our neighbors, Wisconsin and Iowa, with a lot of success. With that, Madam Chair, we have some testifiers.
Thank you. And I have Tamara Walter. If you could please state your name for the record and begin.
For the record, my name is Tamara Walter. Good morning, Chair and committee members. My name is Tamara Walter. I'm a single working mom of two from Blaine, low income constituent, voter, SNAP benefit recipient, and also user of the Market Bucks program. I am for the Market Bucks program. As a SNAP benefit recipient, I get to participate in the Market Bucks program that helps me make my dollars go two-thirds farther. The Market Bucks program is amazing every time you use it during the spring and summer farmers market. We need to keep this program going. However, during the winter farmers market, there is not access to fresh fruits and vegetables. This has a negative impact on my family, not having access to fresh fruits and vegetables with our health conditions. First, 2/3 of my family has type 1 diabetes and type 2 diabetes, which require high protein and lots of fruits and vegetables to keep our blood sugars balanced. Second, we also have celiacs in our home. Celiac disease is an allergy to wheat, barley, rye, and oat, which is also known as gluten. Fresh fruits and vegetables do not contain gluten, so we eat a lot of them. A Fresh Bucks program would be a wonderful addition to the Market Bucks program, which helps my family financially afford purchasing fresh fruits and vegetables with the food prices exponentially rising. In conclusion, this is very important to keep the Market Bucks program going and funding the expansion to Fresh Bucks. Low-income families deserve equality to have access to fresh fruits and vegetables all year long and keep us healthy. Give the green light to the Fresh Produce Bucks program. Thank you, committee and chair members.
Thank you very much. Next, I have Zachary Page. If you could please state your name for the record and begin.
Hello, my name is Zachary Page. I live in Burgess, a small town of 300 in northwest Minnesota, close to Detroit Lakes. In Detroit Lakes, I was elected to the board of the Matta Food Co-op grocery store, where I serve as board president for the past 5 years. So I know firsthand the challenges of rural grocery stores. I often go behind the till, check out customers, and see how many people use the SNAP program at our food co-op. I work for the University of Minnesota Extension, RSDP, or Regional Sustainable Development Partnerships, as Sustainable Ag and Food Systems Coordinator, working on statewide initiatives such as the Rural Grocery Technical Assistance. Rural grocery stores are defined in cities with a population of 5,000 or less and have significantly less resources than larger grocery chains. With smaller stores, grocery managers and owners have to do it all. They have to manage finances, staff, weekly orders for all departments. And the RSDP has been working with rural grocery managers and owners for the past 10 years. We've mailed out an extensive survey in 2015 and 2020, personally reaching out to over 250 stores. With the results, we identified many challenges, including stores interested in selling more fresh produce. We actually held produce handling and produce food safety workshops and trainings in the stores, created a farm-to-grocery toolkit, and have seen an increase in both awareness and stores purchasing more locally produced vegetables to meet the demand of their community and asking for more healthy foods in food desert areas. So I live in Burgess, a town of 300. There's actually a new grocery store there, and the closest store next to them is about 15 miles away. They are interested in selling more locally produced fruits and vegetables at their store and already accept SNAP customers. Where I serve on the board at Matta Food Co-op, we offer affordable, healthy foods. We purchase from over 60 local vendors. So we've seen the Market Bucks program work successfully in farmers markets during the season, but the Fresh Bucks program would extend this health initiative year-round by increasing demand and affordability of produce in these rural grocery stores, which we've seen as a success in other states. So I had the privilege to go to the National Rural Grocery Summit in Alabama this year, where I first learned about the Fresh Bucks program and heard about its success in many other states, many other rural areas as well. And a little side note, Minnesota was actually chosen to host the National Rural Grocery Summit in northwest Minnesota, where I live, in 2026 because of the exemplary work we've been doing in this field. If the bill is adopted, the University of Minnesota RSDP can easily ensure a successful implementation and adoption of such a program. We actually have 5 staff in the region of greater Minnesota through the Good Food Access Program Technical Assistance, which we were awarded. Fresh Bucks program would not only support the vital community health basics, but would also help the rural grocery stores offer something meaningful to their customers, strengthening the local economy and strengthening their customer relations. Foundation, as we know, to a successful, healthy life starts with access to good food, and I strongly encourage all of you to prioritize the Fresh Bucks bill into the final budget. This is a health initiative and a food desert rural areas, increasing access to healthy, fresh food. Thanks.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Yeah. Members, do you have any questions or comments? Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not a question, but just a brief comment. Thank you, Senator Mann, for bringing this bill. We have a fair bit of conversation in this committee about ways to decrease healthcare costs. This is a way to do that, making sure that everyone has access to healthy food, to fresh fruits and vegetables, absolutely has an impact on people's health and keeps them healthier. So thank you for bringing this bill.
Any other questions or comments? Senator Kupek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, too, for Mana Food Co-op. That's a usual stop of mine when I'm over in Detroit Lake. So, so thanks for that. Thanks for the good work that you do over there. Also wish we had a food co-op still where I live, but on my side of the district, but we do not. I also want to just flag this food co-op had gotten a grant from the federal government. They are expanding, and they've taken out a loan on that grant, and that grant was pulled. And so they're right now in a little bit of a financial crunch with a halfway refurbished building. So I wish you luck on that and anything I can do to help with that, too. Thanks. Please let me know.
Yeah, that
Mr. Page.
The regional, RFSI, Regional Food Sustainable Initiative, has been frozen at the moment. So we're making calls right now to Representative Fischbach to see if we could get those funds unfrozen. And the reason for the funds is because we're doing a shared processing kitchen where local farmers can come and process their foods, and then we're getting those foods out to farm to school programs and right in the grocery store.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Senator Mann, this bill needs to go to state government because part of the bill is to move the program, which currently is housed in the Minnesota Humanities Center, I believe, move it to the Department of Human Services, and the Minnesota Humanities Center is a responsibility of the state government committee. So any final thoughts, Senator Mann? So Senator Mann, her motion would be to recommend that Senate file 1858 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government. Members, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? The motion does prevail, and Senate File 1858, as amended, is referred to the Committee on State Government. Next, we'll go to Senate File 1599.
Madam Chair, when you're ready.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate File 1599 relates to the mobile crisis system and services that we have in Minnesota. All 87 counties and 4 tribes are covered by mobile mental health crisis teams. These teams were developed to have a mental health response to a mental health crisis instead of a police response to a mental health crisis. Last year, we learned in a Fox 9 TV report that Ramsey County was charging people for using crisis services. While some services provided by crisis teams can be charged to medical assistance and Minnesota Care, it is rare for private insurance to cover these same services. The grant money provided by the legislature was to ensure access to this service for all Minnesotans. We need these teams operating 24/7, and just like police and fire, when we need them available whenever help is needed. Also like police and fire, we don't want to charge people for these services, and we don't want a financial incentive to have them call the police instead. Additionally, the legislature provided one-time funding in 2023 of roughly $8 million per year, and these critical services are facing a funding cliff because of the way we had to structure the budget in 2023. This bill would do the following: It would not allow crisis teams to charge individuals for the services provided. It references the standards laid out in medical assistance. It deletes previous reference to the one central phone number for crisis teams and inserts 988, which is our current phone service and texting lifeline. It states that copayments, coinsurance, and deductibles do not apply to crisis services under Minnesota Care, and provides an opportunity to provide funding for crisis services and to allow the teams to use funds to purchase and renovate vehicles under protected transport under non-emergency medical transport services. I do have testifiers here to tell you more.
Ms. Abderholden, please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. Minnesota has been trying to build a statewide mental health crisis system for over 20 years. The goal is to create a mental health response to a mental health crisis. When we do that, we decrease interactions with police and decrease the possibility that someone will end up in jail instead of in our mental health system. It has been funded by grant dollars, along with the teams being able to bill Medicaid and Minnesota Care for some of the services they deliver. As was mentioned last summer, Fox 9 reported on Ramsey County charging people for crisis services. This was not for a copay required under insurance, but for the total cost. In fact, we heard from many teams across the state who said they do not charge the individual. They may ask for the copayment, but they do not charge an individual for the full cost. NAMI Minnesota has advocated for crisis services from the beginning, and it was never, ever contemplated that someone would be charged for the full cost of crisis services. This again sets up a financial incentive for the individual to use police instead of crisis teams. We have also had many police departments hiring social workers, which frankly kind of confuses the situation even more. Not only is it kind of unclear about who does what between the mobile crisis teams and a social worker embedded in the police department, but in terms of the activities they can do, complying with HIPAA, but also if it's a co-responder response, when the social worker is an employee of the police department, there is no charge, but when the social worker is employed by the mobile crisis team, then there is. We want the mobile teams to be viewed as fire and police responders. With 988, we actually have increased the connections to our mobile teams. The funding for the teams are far below what they need in order to meet the needs. The total statewide funding for our crisis teams is less than the City of St. Paul's or the City of Duluth Police Department, so they simply cannot respond in the same time frames. But they are very effective and can address many issues over the phone. In 2023, the legislature provided one-time funding for the biennium, which means the teams are facing a funding cliff of $8 million a year. This bill does prevent people from the teams from charging people. It removes any co-payments from Minnesota Care for this service, and it provides an opportunity for additional funding and for those funds to be used for protected transport vehicles. For people who don't know what protected transport is, it was added to non-emergency medical services quite a few years ago, and it's basically an unmarked car that is driven by someone who's taken mental health crisis training so that we can frankly have transport people with dignity when they're in crisis. Unfortunately, we only have about 3 vehicles running in the state of Minnesota, partly due to a low reimbursement rate, but partly because they just aren't available, and we'd like the crisis teams to look at developing those some more. So I appreciate the opportunity to testify, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. We have one testifier on Zoom, Karen Meyering. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Karen Meyering. I'm the Director of Crisis Services at Woodland Centers, which is a certified community behavioral health clinic located in Wilmer, Minnesota. Mobile crisis teams are not new to Minnesota. Woodland Centers has had a 24/7 mobile crisis team since 2016, offering crisis services to children, adolescents, and adults. Our team covers 7 counties and 4,800 square miles in rural West Central Minnesota. Last year, our Woodland Centers team responded to 726 individuals in a crisis and completed over 2,400 crisis services to individuals in our communities. We respond to people experiencing suicidal thoughts, depression, anxiety, psychosis, and other mental health symptoms. Mobile crisis response decreases the need for costly emergency room visits and calling law enforcement in a mental health crisis. Teams coordinate with law enforcement agencies, schools, and other community partners to provide this important service. We also provide follow-up services to connect individuals with ongoing services to prevent future crises. Mobile crisis teams save lives. Crisis grant funding is vital to continue our 24/7 on-call teams, keeping services and staff accessible when needed and at no cost to the caller. We ask for continued funding to operate this emergency service. Thank you, the legislature, for the good work done to build a statewide crisis response system. Woodland Centers and I encourage you to continue this work by sustaining our crisis system with necessary investments to respond to the growing needs in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Meyering. Members' questions? Senator Ruckey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And when we talk about the money needed, there's a blank appropriations on this bill, but I would like to find out more from the past, and I don't know if DHS can join us for a question. And my question will be, how much money from this 2023 appropriation of $8 million, was that all spent? Or is there some left?
Senator Wicklin or anybody else?
Madam Chair, I didn't bring my notes on what we, what I've heard. I don't know if Ms. Bailey came prepared.
I think Ms. Bailey was on her way up here.
I did put it in here. So you did take 1.3.
Ms. Bailey, welcome.
Chairman, members of the committee, Elise Bailey, Budget Director of the Department of Human Services. Senator Aki, can I ask specifically, are you looking for what time period, which appropriation that DHS received? Senator. Or are you looking for, are you just looking for the 2023 appropriation, or are you looking for what was appropriated last year, I guess, is my question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The time period was because it was first appropriated with the 2023 budget, but that was for the biennium. So it would be fiscal year 23 and 24 up till, I guess, June 30th of 24 to have been the end of that, I believe, is the way it was originally appropriated. So 2 years.
Ms. Bailey.
Chairman, Senator Aki. So my understanding is that right now in 2025, we have a $16.8 million one-time appropriation. I think that was reappropriated, and that is good until fiscal year 27. Right now, we're working through, contracts, and my understanding is that the counties, we don't have traditional contracts with counties that they, when they incur the costs, then they bill the state. And so it's a little bit of a different encumbering setup where we don't know how quickly the funds will be spent. They could be billing us up until June 30th of the fiscal year. So right now we have $15.6 million available, but that has carry forward through June 30th, 2027.
Senator Ruckey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'm hearing this is already an ongoing appropriation. And we were just talking about it being a one-time. Can you clarify, is it ongoing?
There's base funding.
Chairman, Senator Aki, we have a one-time appropriation and we have base funding for these grants.
Senator Aki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So is the base funding $8 million per biennium?
Ms. Bailey.
Chair, Senator Arkey, I'd have to double check. I have $24.7 million is the base that includes the tribal. We have a $1 million tribal appropriation.
Senator Arkey.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Okay, so we've got the 24.7 base, and then in 23 there was an additional $8 million put on top of that. But now we're looking at an appropriation again on top of the base is what I'm thinking. Is that correct, Senator Wicklund?
Senator Wicklund.
I I believe that would be yes. And just a little bit of an addition, there was in 2024, there was some unspent money, and then we took that 1.3 million that was unspent, and then we reallocated it to other mental health programs. So we did look at last year, you know, we wanted to make sure that we were efficiently using the funding, and so that was done to make sure that mental health programs could make use of the money if it wasn't being spent, wasn't going to be used. I just want to comment too about just the need for funding. It looks like in 2023, there were tribes and adult mental health initiatives that applied for $29 million in state funding, and there was $19 million available. And so, I mean, we see that there is an application need for more funding than we have available. That doesn't mean that it all gets used up exactly in that order. For 2024, agencies asked for $35 million, and there was $22 million available. So. I think there is a greater need than what we are funding today.
Senator Ecke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the last question I have is, you know, we do kind of see where the numbers or the money is coming from, but it starts out and talks about the county boards must provide. Do we know what that shift or obligation that we're putting towards our counties would be? I don't know, Ms. Bailey, do you guys have anything calculated from the Department of Human Services there, or is that something we can get? Because I'm concerned about the local impact. You know, we all hear the same. Counties are getting bombarded with these extra obligations, and I, you know, that's the first thing that popped out on this one again, so if anybody can help me with that.
Ms. Bailey or Senator Ms. Abderholden?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Utke, that's actually been in statute for a long, long time. As part of the Adult and Children's Mental Health Act, they are supposed to be covering crisis services.
Senator Utke.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the only comment I'd have there is we're talking about the growing needs. So again, this is a growing cost shift to the counties, and I would I guess then maybe we need to do a local impact study to really find out what that is, because if it's, you know, and it, I do see it's not new language, but it's a concerning piece that I'd like to know what it is. But we can follow up with that. Thank you.
Any other comments?
Madam Chair, Senator Utke, can I just mention that at the end of both the Adult and Children's Mental Health Act, it says within available appropriations, there's language in there. So the entire Adult and Children's Mental Health Act doesn't mean, I mean, right now the counties don't meet all of these things because they have that restriction, if you will, on top of that. So this isn't requiring anything new from them other than not charging an individual directly.
Senator Bolden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have two questions. The first is about funding. Is the funding for this, does that come solely from the state, or are there federal dollars that come to help to fund these services as well?
Senator Wicklin.
I'll let Ms. Abderholden answer.
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Senator Bolden, around 5% of the federal mental health block grant is to go to crisis services.
Senator Bolden.
Thank you. And then my second question is about the geographic distribution of these services. I am certain there are, you know, is a need for this all across the state. And we've talked about the needs. Current state, can you talk a little bit about the sort of the geographic distribution of what is currently available across the state? Where is that and where is it not?
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Senator Bolden, it's actually covering all 87 counties and then 4 tribes.
Center. Any other questions? Seeing none, Senate File 1599 will be laid over. And with that, we have come to the end of our agenda, and we are adjourned.
Thank you. I know the money thing gets complicated.